Coming up on Fronteras, if you've been following the immigration reform debate, here's a pop quiz for you.
Total number of immigrants minus the number of immigrants here legally is the number who are here without authorization.
Give up? The answer is 11 million, of course. Coming up, the Fronteras desk takes a closer look at that number. In October, states will begin operating health care exchanges, online marketplaces mandated under the Affordable Care Act. That may mean new patients for the Indian Health Service.
We want to be able to promote ourselves in a way that we want their health care dollars spent here, and we welcome them.
The changing face of tribal health programs under Obamacare. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations and funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its Local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. Latinos appear to be narrowing the education gap that has long separated them from their white peers. Jill Replegal from our Fronteras desk tells us about the latest indicator.
For the first time, a higher percentage of Latino high school graduates are going on to college than their white peers. That's according to a new analysis from the Pew Hispanic Center. 7 out of 10 Latino graduates of the class of 2012 enrolled in college last fall, compared to a slightly lower percentage of white graduates. Just a decade ago, only about half of Latino high school graduates went to college. At the same time, the dropout rate for Latino high school students has fallen to a record low, to 14% in 2011, according to the Pew report. But despite their gains, Latinos are still nearly 3 times as likely to drop out of high school as whites, and those Latinos who do go on to college are less likely than whites to enroll in a 4-year college and less likely to earn a bachelor's degree. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replegal.
It was a hot topic on social media this week. The Walt Disney Company attempt to trademark Dia de los Muertos. Disney has since said it will withdraw its trademark applications related to the Day of the Dead holiday. Fronteras reporter Monica Ortiz-Uribe reported Disney made the decision late Tuesday after an avalanche of backlash online. Uribe is joining us now to talk about how she found out about Disney's latest trademark attempt.
Well, like I do every morning, usually, I go through my Twitter feed and kind of search for news and just interesting stuff, whatever's going on that day. And one of the things I saw was tweeted by a Mexican political site, and they were the ones that tweeted about this trademark request by Disney. So, you know, I did some searching, and I found out that the original source for the story was coming from an industry blog. It's a blog that focuses on Disney, and so yeah, they were the ones that put out the news first. Disney was seeking to trademark the phrase Dia de los Muertos. So the next step was to go and check at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and sure enough, there were 10 different requests for the phrase Dia de los Muertos by Disney Inc. And this was for stuff like children's toys, all kinds of food, clothes, and even stuff like toothpaste.
And this is for an upcoming movie, is that right?
Yes. So Disney is developing a movie. It's still in the very early stages, I'm told, of a movie inspired by the Mexican holiday, Dia de los Muertos. And so, I mean, this is a pretty typical procedure for Disney, right? We know that they market all of their movies with all kinds of merchandise. So they were just doing what they normally do in preparation for a film.
What were people saying?
Right. But this was not the normal response that Disney is used to, right? Or they're used to getting no response, right? But because this is a culturally sensitive topic, Dia de los Muertos is a sacred religious holiday in Mexico where people celebrate the dead. It coincides in early November with All Souls Day. And lately, it's gained a lot of popularity in the United States, where you'll see American cities and people who aren't of Mexican origin celebrating the holiday. Right? You'll see I'm sure you've seen the people's faces painted with
skulls.
Right. 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 And so, when word got out, and we as our public radio network put the word out on social media, this is what's happening, and we just got a huge response, and most of it was negative. And you would see things like people would tweet or post on their Facebook, "Our culture is not for sale," and like, "Keep your corporate hands off," things like that.
So social media really helped propel this backlash, it sounds like, backlash.
It did. And a clear example of that was a woman in Colorado. She's from Mexico. She's a teacher and a traditional Mexican healer. She started a petition online at around 10 in the morning. And 7 hours later, she had, I think it was more than 10,000 signatures of support, right? And this petition was asking Disney to remove their trademark request for Día de los Muertos.
And now it's my understanding they did withdraw. And was Fronteras kind of the lead on that story?
They did withdraw, and it was incredible to watch, right? From the morning when we reported the story for the first time to 6-7 hours later after putting in calls to Disney. Fronteras did get a response from a spokeswoman via email, saying that Disney had made the decision to change the title of its film, and it was going to remove its trademark requests.
So they didn't say this was because of in response to the public?
They did not. They said that Disney made the decision to change the title of its upcoming film, and thereby it was removing its trademark requests. So in no way, you know, but I mean, you know, you can put two and two together, right? It would be a huge coincidence, right, if the two were not related.
Disney is such a big powerhouse. Is this unprecedented for the people to chime in and say, "No, we don't want this to turn corporate"?
No. This has happened before. I'm not sure if in terms of timeliness, this certainly happened incredibly quickly. But there have been other instances in the past. The one that we reported on was that in the past, Disney had sought to trademark the phrase the SEAL Team 6, which was the U.S. team, the military team responsible for the assassination of Osama bin Laden. So Disney applied for the trademark for that phrase. That was met with a huge negative response, and they and after that they removed their request to trademark that term. So yes, it's happened before.
Monica Ortiz Uribe from our Fronteras Network, thanks for all of your hard work on this story and all the digging you did. Great work.
You're welcome.
11 million, that's the estimated number of immigrants living in the U.S. illegally. The number has become the most cited statistic in the immigration reform debate. But how did we even arrive at that figure? Who are these 11 million? And is it even the best number to use? From the Fronteras desk, Adrian Florido takes a closer look.
Jeffrey Pascel is the man responsible for the number. He's senior demographer at the Pew Hispanic Center. And to arrive at 11 million, he collected a bunch of government data and used this formula.
Total number of immigrants minus the number of immigrants here legally is the number who are here without authorization.
Sounds simple, right? It's not. In fact, 26 years ago, when Ronald Reagan signed an amnesty for about 3 million immigrants, many people argued there were 3 to 4 times that many. The formula Pascel uses, actually quite complicated, is now largely accepted as the best one.
Today, there's a much broader agreement about how many people we're talking about and about who we're talking about.
So then let's accept that 11 million figure as the number of people here without documents. That's more than the total population of Greece, by the way. But who are they? some of what the Pew Center has found is probably no surprise. About 6 million of the 11 million are Mexicans, 60% are men, a majority live in large states like California, Texas, Illinois, and New York. But more than 4 million now live in other states, too, in the South, the Midwest, and the Northwest, giving all those regions a larger stake in an immigration reform bill.
It's a part of, I think, the demographic underpinnings of what's turned this into a national debate instead of a local debate.
There are also hundreds of thousands of Salvadorans, Guatemalans, Chinese, Koreans, and Filipinos. Many of those from countries overseas didn't even start off as immigrants. Ben Winograd is a former attorney at the American Immigration Council.
About 40% enter the country through a port of entry and then just overstay their visa.
And if you keep digging into the 11 million, yet another picture emerges, a picture of families. Passell says a majority of unauthorized immigrants are here with spouses and children.
And I think that is not by any means the stereotype people have of this population.
There are families like that of Gloria Mejia. On a recent afternoon, she was picking her 8-year-old son Joaquin up from school in San Diego.
¿Cómo te fue la escuela?
Bien.
¿Bien? ¿Sí? Bien, bien.
Mejia says being undocumented has made it hard to help her kids get ahead.
Me da tristeza no poder que vaya yo a ayudarlos más.
Even Joaquin, her youngest child and the only one who's a U.S. citizen, has been affected.
Hay ocasiones donde él quiere salir y
él juega soccer.
She says he wants to join a traveling soccer team, but he can't because she's afraid to travel with him.
The example that you've given is so perfect that you can't travel across states. To participate in a soccer tournament, it may mean that a mother is less likely to go to a PTA conference.
Michael Fix is senior vice president of the Migration Policy Institute. He says recent research has shown that children who are U.S. citizens are affected long-term, cognitively, socially, and educationally, by having undocumented parents who live in the shadows. Jeff Passell says 4.5 million American citizen children live in families with undocumented parents. He says that's important to understand when considering the actual impact of a bill that would grant unauthorized immigrants legal status.
Instead of 11 million people, we're talking more about 16 million people who would be affected by a law.
For the 11 million number that's become so ubiquitous, that is a pretty big asterisk. But Passell says 16 million may be just as important a number. In San Diego, I'm Adrian Florido.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. Young people in the Mormon church are called to serve a 2-year mission. But what happens if you're sent on a mission and you have no immigration papers?
When we let fear take over us, we start losing faith. And when we lose faith, we don't have a future.
We share the personal story of one young Latino's mission. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Since 2000, the number of Spanish-speaking Mormons in the U.S. has just about doubled. Many of those Latino Mormons don't have legal documentation, which poses a problem for the church. Young Mormons are called to serve missions, 2 years on the road, trying to convert strangers to the faith. So what happens when Mormons without papers come of legal age and set off on their missions? Jack Rodolico of LatitudeNews.com brings us one of their stories.
We'll call him by his middle name, Isaac, and his story starts with his father, back in Mexico before Isaac was born. When he was 17, Isaac's dad got a job building a Mormon church in Mexico City. The church bishop took an interest in him, and they became fast friends.
My dad decided to read the Book of Mormon and decided to be baptized.
Isaac's family moved from Mexico to the U.S., and sadly, when Isaac was 5, his father died in a car crash. 2 nights after the accident, Isaac told his little sister,
"Do you see that little star? That's Dad. He's watching over us right now. So don't worry about Dad watching us. I'm here to help you out."
And he did. As a teenager, Isaac would slip $20 bills into his mother's purse, money he earned mowing lawns. And when Isaac was 18, he was getting excited to set out on his Mormon mission. But then his mother told him,
"I don't know how to put this in words to you, but you're not a U.S. citizen. You are an illegal immigrant from Mexico."
The Pew Research Center estimates there are over 100,000 undocumented immigrants of working age in Utah, where Isaac lives. They're filling the ranks of many churches, but they're putting the Mormon church in a particularly tricky spot. Tony Yapias is a Peruvian immigrant, a Mormon, and a longtime community organizer in Salt Lake City. He says he's known hundreds of missionaries who lacked papers. The issue became critical, he says, in 2009, when a Latino missionary was arrested by immigration agents in an Ohio airport.
That had a profound impact in the church, and it became a concern for parents, a concern for missionaries.
The church declined to comment on this story, but it's clearly taken steps along the way to protect itself and its missionaries. In 2005, it backed an amendment by a Utah senator to a federal law giving churches immunity for having immigrants without papers do volunteer service, including serving missions. Over the years, the church has developed an evolving don't ask, don't tell policy on its undocumented missionaries.
When the immigration issue started heating up, at some point they knew, the church knew that they were undocumented, and then they could no longer send them outside the country on missions.
So by the time Isaac went on his mission, the church was encouraging these missionaries to accept assignments in the U.S., off airplanes, within a long drive from home. On his mission in Denver, Colorado, the problems Isaac faced were less legal and more spiritual.
I remember being rejected constantly. It was nonstop. We'd knock on the door, they would insult us.
But he found an open door at the home of Guadalupe Paredes, a Mexican Mormon immigrant who had been inactive in the church for 24 years. I spoke to Guadalupe by Skype with her daughter Soraya translating. She says one day, Isaac pulled out a picture of his father, and she recognized him.
She said, "I know that man. His name is Rafael."
¿Y cuando me le enseñó?
And when I saw it,
she told me that her dad baptized my dad.
Guadalupe's father was the Mormon bishop back in Mexico who built the church alongside Isaac's father and baptized him. Guadalupe told Isaac stories about his father. Meeting her opened up a window into his father's life and his faith.
When we let fear take over us, we start losing faith, and when we lose faith, we don't have a future.
2 years later, Isaac's now applying for the Obama administration's deferred action. If approved, he can go to college without fearing deportation. For Fronteras, I'm Jack Rodolico.
This story comes with support from PRX and the Open Society Foundations. Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Health Care Act is expected to bring in much-needed dollars to the chronically underfunded Indian Health Service, or IHS. But tribal health experts say the main game-changer in Indian country will be new health insurance exchanges. For the first time ever, the IHS, a system traditionally open only to Native Americans, will be competing for non-Indian patients in order to survive. From New Mexico, Tristan Atone reports.
There are 27 Indian Health Service, or IHS, facilities in New Mexico, and most are located in some very rural areas. So rural, they're often described as frontier. The Pueblo of Jemez's clinic is one of those rural IHS clinics, where Dave Panana serves as nurse manager and today tour guide.
We have 7 rooms. The first 2 are for triage, and then the other 5 are for regular doctor visit exam rooms.
The clinic handles ambulatory care, dental, standard x-rays, all the services a rural community like Jemez Pueblo needs.
This is our lab, so we do basic point-of-care testing too as well, your normal A1Cs, your UAs, hemoglobins, etc.
On Jemez, about 55% of the patients that come in are currently uninsured, which means that IHS and Jemez Pueblo absorb the medical costs of that population. But Panana says that's about to change.
Hopefully that number will go down, especially with the health insurance exchanges that are coming down in 2014.
Health insurance exchanges are marketplaces for people to buy private insurance. In essence, it will be like comparing prices for airline tickets online, and once you purchase an insurance plan, you're locked into a network. Here's how the exchanges could benefit the Indian Health Service. If IHS clinics are contracted with these private insurance plans, suddenly more non-Indian patients will be able to access healthcare at places like Jemez Pueblo. Maria Clark is the director of the Pueblo's Health and Human Services Department.
They pass us every day wondering, wow, it would be really neat if I could just go there. It would be such a short drive. It would be a wonderful convenience. So we want to be able to promote ourselves in a way that we want their healthcare dollars spent here, and we welcome them.
I think that health reform with the exchanges are going to forge a new business model mindset within the Indian health system.
That's Jim Roberts, a Native American health expert with the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board. He says right now in Oregon, the Indian health system has already been integrating into the state's exchange, and he says that the idea is spreading.
In Washington State, we have begun that process where I have no doubt fully that our programs will be able to provide services to non-Indians and Indians served by qualified health plans.
Another opportunity the state's health exchange offers tribes will be the ability to purchase supplemental insurance plans for their members. For tribal citizens with serious medical issues, tribal governments could opt to purchase plans for them through the exchange instead of dipping into limited IHS funds from the federal government. That's according to April Wilkinson, program specialist for the Pueblo of Jemez.
So if we can pay $100 premium a month for somebody that has some significant illnesses and utilize that insurance to help supplement what we would have put out for their health care bill, we're going to do that.
But that's only viable if the insurance plan lists Jemez and other IHS clinics in their networks, which is happening, but slowly. Becky Kenny is with Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Blue Cross and Blue Shield of New Mexico is including IHS clinics in our exchange network as we consider them to be essential community providers here in our state.
Across the country, healthcare exchanges won't be up and running until October. But already, many health insurance providers are seeing opportunities in tribes, reportedly showing up on reservations around New Mexico looking to sign up tribal members for private insurance. From Albuquerque, New Mexico, I'm Tristan Ottone.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook. We invite you to join the conversation and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is fronterasdesk. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.